So today we get into some, it's a little complex to pinpoint the chronology for much of what we're going to be covering today. And we're going to be covering, really, the emphasis is this war where that Rezin, who's the king of Syria, and Pekah, the king in Israel, have made this coalition. And they're going against Judah. And there are some interesting things that go on, and there are just there are a few chronology problems that we'll have to talk about. In general, those of you who are teaching children, you don't want to bother with that. I mean, you'll waste time talking about that if you're teaching the children. I would say that's probably true, really on up through high school. That's, you probably don't want to spend much, if any, time talking about the chronology of it. Maybe at the high school age, just to deal with some who may hear some skeptics talking about, well, there are contradictions in the Bible, and give them some ammunition to deal with that. But beyond that, I wouldn't spend a lot of time on that. We also have some geography to cover in this morning's lesson. And again, the geography here, I think, is very important, because it's more than just learning maps in this lesson. However, those of you who are teaching children, learning maps can be fun. And that's something where that when you're teaching children, you can teach them the maps, and you don't necessarily have to make an application other than this story took place, you know, in this specific geographic place. You can talk to the children about that. And children love maps. They love to draw the maps, and they love to find cities. They love to, you know, color the blue water and the green land or the brown land, and try to find a city and to have help. They like to write on the board. So you've got all kinds of tools like that, because there is some geography to cover in this. But there's also, as you're teaching the older classes, and you can make this point with the younger ones as well, there's a lesson in the geography in this today's lesson. There's a lesson in that you see the geography of the land that they covered shrink. And the Bible gives a very specific reason for that shrinking of the geography. So you can show actually how it shrank, and the children can learn the maps, learn the places. They can see the areas where the people lived and they were taken away. And they can visualize that. They can, you know, be interactive with that. So that's a way to approach that with children. You won't have any problem, I don't think, filling the time teaching children in this lesson, even though there is some complex history going on. You can in this lesson with the children, I think there's plenty for you to keep them engaged, and also to teach them some very important lessons that they can apply. So I think, you know, you look at this and you're thinking the story of Pekah and Rezin and Syria and Ahaz and Jotham, and you think it's all confusing, but really the children can learn what's going on in the story. They can understand, and they can have an interactive lesson as well. So I would encourage you teachers to think about that and give it some thought as you're teaching the younger ones, and even on up into high school. They can get the concept of the map and get that reinforced. They probably should have seen it earlier as they were going through it in another cycle. But then at this time through, they can get that. And maybe you could go a little more in the chronology with the children. But this is going to be the focus, is that war between Judah and this Israel-Syria coalition. And I say Judah, for the most part, it's Ahaz. But the Bible is very specific in pointing out that this began in the days of Jotham. So before Jotham died, this kind of war was going on between Israel and Syria and Judah. So start with a review, as we always do. Again, this is the first half, just to kind of keep in mind the contrast between the kingdoms, how that there was the occasional good king in Judah. They were all evil, and you can see also the instability in Israel. And again, with the children, you can work on memorizing the list of the kings. And I didn't fix that, but we get down to Menahem, Uzziah in Judah, and then we're in the days of Uzziah's son, Jotham, right now. And then there's still instability in Israel. Pekah is now the king in Israel. Okay. And Jotham, we're in his last years right now. Jotham is still king when we begin. But then Jotham's son is about to take over. And the Bible points out, as we'll see when we get into the text, that Ahaz was the most wicked king that Judah had seen to date. And that Ahaz was actually more wicked than the guy in Israel who kind of sounds like his name, Ahab. And even more wicked than Ahab. And there are some firsts for Ahaz that we'll look at in just a moment. And then later on we'll get into Hezekiah and Hoshea, the last king in Israel. And another thing that's happening here is it's not as if Israel was taken away captive at once. Right? We're seeing that there are pieces, parts of the kingdom of Israel that are already gone in today's lesson. Even though the kingdom is still active, even though Pekah is still king, and then Hoshea is yet to follow him, parts of Israel are gone. And when we put that 721 date, we're talking about the fall of the capital, which is Samaria. Okay? And we'll see all of that. So, questions? We're all good about where we are in the kingdom? Who's king? How far along we are? How close we are to Israel's ultimate fall? And Judah being left alone? Okay? Real quick review of the prophets. Okay? You might want to just hit this every time as well. Obadiah, Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Micah, the prophets during the divided kingdom. We've covered all of those prophets. And we're going to go back in today's lesson and hit some more of Isaiah because he gives us some historical perspective that we need to study in this morning's lesson. It gives us, the way I kind of refer to it is God's point of view on what's going on. And it's an interesting study because oftentimes we study the history or the prophets and not both of them together. And we've gotten an overview of the prophets in this class, so we know Isaiah's message, right? We know that the first part, the emphasis of the first part of the book was the judgment, even though there were glimpses of, you know, the hope that was coming. Okay? And we're going to see that, and he deals specifically with the historical events in his prediction of judgment that's coming to Judah. Okay? All right, let's look first. You know, we begin in 1 Chronicles chapter 5. And in my studies with Bob, one of the things that he's pointed out to me, and 1 Chronicles chapters 1 through 9, the way he's defined that section of the Bible is 1 Chronicles 1 through 9, that's knowledge of those chapters separates the true Bible student from someone who just knows a little bit about it. And I still fall in that category of someone who just knows a little bit about it. And I have a lot to learn about 1 Chronicles 1 through 9 and how that really fits into the rest of the Bible story. But a nice little, you know, lots of genealogies and then an occasional historical nugget thrown in there in those chapters. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 25 and 26, referring to the genealogy of Manasseh on the eastern side of the Jordan. Okay? And he says, "And they were unfaithful to the God of their fathers and played the harlot after the gods of the peoples of the land whom God had destroyed before them. So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, that is Tiglath-Pileser." Okay? So that's the same Tiglath-Pileser we're dealing with in these days. Okay? Tiglath-Pileser is the king in Assyria that we're going to be dealing with. That bond between Israel and Syria. And don't confuse, that's one thing you may have to work with your children on. Do not confuse Syria and Assyria. They're two different kingdoms, right? They're not the same. They're not related. Okay? And so Tiglath-Pileser is the king of Assyria. And Assyria is the kingdom that actually took Israel away captive, that took Samaria. Okay? So keep that straight. So Tiglath-Pileser is the king of Assyria. And he carried the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh into captivity. So who are the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh? Those on the east side of the Jordan. Remember that from a few quarters ago when we studied the invasion and conquest of the land. Okay? So do keep that in mind. Okay? And he goes on and tells where that he took them to. But he took those on the east side of the Jordan away. And again, it is difficult to pinpoint exactly when these on the eastern side were taken away in relation to the events we're going to study. But it was Tiglath-Pileser. So we're probably in the days of Pekah is when this happened. Okay? So Pekah would have been king in Israel. Another thing to keep in mind is I think the Bible does make it clear that there wasn't just this one invasion where he came and he took the Reubenites, the Gadites, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and then all of those that we're going to read about later, Naphtali and Zebulun, and you know those on the west side, the northern parts of the kingdom. It's not like just one big fell swoop and he took all those. I think it came, you know, in waves. And I think we'll see that as we look into the text. And likewise in the attacks on Judah, similarly, you know, it wasn't just one big attack. It was multiple attacks. And that's typically how, you know, how a war goes, right? There are battles along the way that make up the war. And I think this is probably what happened here. The other thing that's interesting in 1 Chronicles 5, and this is a lesson that's going to recur throughout today, and that is, why were they taken away captive? What'd they do? Exactly. The gods of the land whom God had driven out. Do you see how it makes that point? That God had, you know, God had taken care of that. He had destroyed those people before them, but they kept their gods and they fell into that trap. And that was disobedience to even hold on to those gods, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't that a very clear commandment of what they were supposed to do when they took the land was to rid the land of those idols? Did they do that? No, right? No. And I think a very good lesson for that, that you can teach, even going back, and especially as you're teaching, if you do get an opportunity to teach the invasion and conquest later on, but even now you can revisit that and make that point that disobeying God in what may seem like a small thing early on yields consequences much, much later on. You can't foresee all of the bad things that are going to come just because you disobey in a small thing. That's going to have consequences later on. Sin by nature is that way, isn't it? If you hold on to some small part of sin, it will grow and it will grow and it will grow if you continue to hold on to it. The only way to get rid of it, right, is to completely wipe it out, to change a heart, to have a heart that doesn't want any part of sin in any fashion, right? And when you notice sin, when you recognize sin, your immediate effort is to eliminate it from your thoughts, from your minds, to have no admiration, no desire for it, right? And that's clearly where the people fell. They had a longing, they had a fascination with those idols, and a fascination with sin. Even what may seem harmless to us is a very, very dangerous thing that will lead us to ruin, to destruction. And I think that's a lesson that is absolutely taught as we look through this. And again, in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 29, so we'll flip over there as well. 1 Kings 15, we'll spend some time in 2 Kings 15. We'll spend, that says 1 Kings, that is a typo on the slide. That's 2 Kings 15. And we're going to spend some time coinciding with sometime in 2 Kings 15, 2 Kings 16, mostly 16, as well as 2 Chronicles 28. That's the focus of the lesson this morning. So you'll see in 2 Kings 15, 29, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser came and took Ijon, Abel-Beth-Maacah, Genoa, Kedesh, Hazor, Gilead. Now Gilead, where's Gilead? It's the east side of the Jordan. Hey, you see that? So that could be a reference to what we just read in 1 Chronicles 5, but it may be referring to something different. Okay? It may have been a different battle, or you know, it's more of a summary. It's hard to pinpoint all that. And then he says, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them away captive to Assyria. Okay? Right. So again, timing is difficult there. 2 Kings 15, verse 37, while we're there, just a few verses down, it's talking about Jotham. And while Jotham was still king in those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. Okay, so I think that 1537 makes it clear that the beginning of this war was in the days of Jotham. All right? And then we're going to get more details on the war in the days of Ahaz, where it really turns up its intensity, and we get more details on that. So Pekah and Rezin. Remember, Rezin was, the Bible mentions, king of Damascus. So Damascus would have been that capital city of Syria, not Assyria. Remember, Assyria, the key city in Assyria is what? Remind me. Nineveh, right? Nineveh would be that key city in Assyria. Okay? And one thing to point out, I mentioned the chronology problem. And if you have Bob's book on page 116, he goes into some possible explanations. And then he closes that out by saying, it would not be wise to go into a discussion of this in most classes. And I don't intend to spend much time on it, but I do want to point out to you that there appears to be a chronology problem here. All right? If you look at 2 Kings, that should be 15. Wow, I was careless. If you look at 2 Kings 15 and verse 30, right? And the skeptic would look at this and say, see, the Bible is just full of errors. You can't believe anything it says. But look at 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 30. And notice what year that was. The 20th year of whom? Okay, how many years did Jotham reign? Look at verse 33. 16 years. So how could it be in the 20th year of Jotham if Jotham only reigned for 16 years? Do you see that? That's where the skeptic's going to come in. Now, one of the things that really I would point out to anyone who talks to me about that is I would say, look, that's the same author. And it's just a few verses apart. I mean, you wouldn't go right after someone else who wrote a book. I mean, the same author, just a few verses apart, is not going to make an error that egregious. He's going to know what he's talking about in both places. Do you see the point there? That if it were, you know, if it were something totally different in Chronicles and something than what you find in Kings, then maybe, you know, you would have to deal with it in a slightly different way. But I think there are a couple of explanations. One is that Jotham, you know, it doesn't say that he died right at the end of his reign. So perhaps after Ahaz took his place, then, you know, in the 20th year of Jotham. So it would be the 20th year after Jotham began his reign. I think that's a possible explanation. May not be the best one, but that's certainly... when you look at something that has, that's an apparent contradiction, this is something I like to do. If there's an apparent contradiction, you don't have to find the perfect answer that is the one that answers them all. What you need to do is find at least one, more than one perhaps, reasonable explanation for what is a contradiction that could reasonably explain it away based on the details we are given. The bottom line is we're not given all the details we need to come up with one definitive answer to explain this difference in chronology. But there are reasonable explanations for that. And we need to come up with one or two, and we can work with that.
Possibly a co-reign.
Exactly. It did happen to several kings. Yeah, exactly. That's another possible explanation of this. And Bob goes into that in his book, basically saying in 2 Kings 17 and verse 1, you know, Hoshea began ruling in the 12th year of Ahaz. Yet he smote Pekah in the 3rd year of Ahaz. And some would say there's a 9-year gap between Pekah's rule and that of Hoshea. So that's another thing to consider. There were oftentimes co-regents, right? And then there were oftentimes gaps between the reign of one king to the other. So the numbers, and I've done a little exercise in this in my studies, and I honestly, I get frustrated. I can't put it all together. And I think part of the reason is, you know, all the answers just aren't there. But one thing that has to happen is there have to be co-regencies where that a king and his son are reigning together. And there also are times where there just have to be gaps between the end of one king's reign and the beginning of the next one. And that explains a lot of the chronology problems. And I think this is certainly something that could be here. And again, Bob says others combine 2 Kings 15:30 and 17:1 and say that the last year of Pekah, the first year of Hoshea, and the 12th year of Ahaz, and the 20th year of Jotham were all the same year. By having some co-regencies mixed in there, they put those together. And I think that's reasonable as well.
Okay. You know, when Uzziah, after he was struck,
yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly. And Jotham was his son. Yes. Yep, there could have been. That's right. And so it could have been counting some of that time as well in this 20th year. That's a possible explanation, definitely. So you just need to come up with reasonable explanations. And again, you know, the point I made at the beginning, I think, is worthy of consideration as well. You wouldn't take someone, just a human author, and say, see, he's a liar just because there's some numbers you don't quite understand that close together. You see my point? I mean, you would assume that you know, that close together, three verses apart, that, you know, there wouldn't be such an obvious contradiction. And so there is an explanation. That's the point. Again, teaching children, do not go into this, right? Teaching high schoolers, you might mention the concept that I just mentioned about, you know, you need a reasonable explanation, and give them a couple of reasonable explanations like we just did. Okay? So those, but I don't know that I would discuss it before the high school age. But as teacher training, you need to be aware of it. All right, Isaiah 7 is really interesting. This war between, we're getting now where it's Ahaz is the king and Pekah and Rezin are in this coalition. And Isaiah 7 is interesting, and it gives us some insight, some more insight into Ahaz's character. So we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 7 briefly. So you'll notice in verse 1 of Isaiah 7, it's in the days of Ahaz, and Rezin and Pekah are in a coalition, and they're going to Jerusalem to make war against it. Now, This will make some sense if you think it through. Probably, Rezin and Pekah are in this coalition to try to protect themselves from whom? Assyria, right? There are two kingdoms. They see Assyria coming, and two are stronger than one. Alone, neither one of them had any chance against Assyria. Together, they didn't really either, but apparently it would have improved their chances. And perhaps, and I think Isaiah 7 may bring this out a little bit, perhaps they wanted Ahaz to join them in this coalition, three being stronger than two. And Ahaz, for whatever reason, refused to do that. Okay? And that was why they were making this war against him. Jotham would have refused, and then Ahaz as well. And I think, you know, verse 6, you know, it gets into why, when they say, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, make a gap in its wall and set a king over them. You see, so their idea is to set a king over them, perhaps someone who would be willing to join their coalition in Isaiah 7 and verse 6. Do you see that? So that kind of might explain some of the reasoning behind this war. But not so much important that there is a war. The way that Isaiah refers, he tells him, verse 3, to go and meet Ahaz. Okay? He tells him, do not fear or be faint-hearted, verse 4, for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin in Syria and the son of Remaliah. Remaliah, the son of Remaliah is Pekah. Right? So, what's God saying about those two kings there? What's He saying? Nothing. Right? Like a firebrand. You've seen a coal that's just about to burn out. Right? That's how He describes them. They're about to burn out. They're done. They're, don't fear them. They're done. And that's his message to Ahaz. You know, they've taken counsel against you, but don't fear verse 7. It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. And then notice verse 8 at the end. within 65 years, right, Ephraim will be broken. So he's saying in a very short amount of time, Ephraim is going to be taken away. And he also specifically mentions that it will be Assyria who takes them away. And he tells Ahaz to ask for a sign from the Lord. But Ahaz refuses. He will not ask for a sign. And God said, okay, that's the way you want it. You're wearying God, but if that's the way you want it, and he tells him of a sign in verse 14, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. So there's that messianic prophecy. And the point is, before all of this happens, okay, before all of this happens, verse 17, the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day Ephraim departed from Judah. So that prophecy of the coming Messiah, but before that happens, Assyria is going to take Israel away captive, I think is the message there. So very interesting glimpse into the history and how that God called Ahaz to repent and gave Ahaz an opportunity to do better than he did. And Ahaz refused. He would not obey the commandment of God through Isaiah. The war appeared to come in phases. If you look at 2 Kings. So, any questions, thoughts about Isaiah 7 there? Right, right. Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, there's a verse that really points that out. Verse 9, at the close of verse 9. If you will not believe, surely you will not be established. And that's pointing out exactly what you said, Ahaz's lack of faith. Yeah, very good. Very good. And he chose not to believe. He chose not to obey the command to look for a sign, and that's an interesting contrast with Gideon. Very good point. Appreciate that. Other thoughts from Isaiah 7? All right, let's look at 2 Kings chapter 16. And also 2 Chronicles 28. So the war appeared to come in phases, and I say that because of, if you look at 2 Kings 16 and verse 5, you'll see Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, they came up to Jerusalem to make war, and they besieged Ahaz, but they couldn't overcome Judah. They couldn't overcome Ahaz, right? But then you compare that to the account in 2 Chronicles 28, and what happens in 2 Chronicles 28? Right? If you look at about verse 5, God delivered them into the hand of the king of Syria, and this is talking about Judah, and they defeated them, and they carried away a great multitude of them as captives, brought them to Damascus. And as you verse 6, Pekah killed 120,000 in Judah. So I think the best explanation here is that there was a wave, right, in this attack on Judah. A wave where that once they were unsuccessful, the second time, or maybe a different time, may not have been the second time, we don't know. But another time they came and they were much more successful, killing 120,000 and taking captives away. And they carried away, the children of Israel took away captives from Judah, and they took them to Samaria, and some were taken to Damascus as well by Syria. And then there's Oded, verse 9 of 2 Chronicles 28. There's a prophet of the Lord whose name was Oded, and he went and he rebuked the leaders of Israel in Samaria, rebuked them sharply. And he said, because God was angry with Judah, that's why you were able to take these captives. That's why you were able to do that. But you've killed them in a rage that reaches to heaven. And now you want to force them to be your slaves? That's going to add more sin to the sin you've already committed. God's already angry with you, right? He's angry with Judah too, that point's made. But He's already angry with you. And by you taking these people captive, you're going to make God even more angry with you. And apparently, Oded's words had some impact. Because the leaders there in Israel, they listened to Oded, and they took those captives, and they treated them well, they fed them, they gave them water, gave them clothing, administered first aid to those who were injured, took care of them. Those who were weak, they put on donkeys, and they returned those captives. They didn't keep them. They returned them back to Jerusalem. So interesting how that a prophet comes, he speaks the word, and even though that that they're already gone, they're already sinful, they heed the word of Oded and don't add this sin to their list of sins already. And I think there's another lesson in that, and that is that even when our standing for the truth and our saying what God wants us to say, we may think it's doing no good. Even just a little bit of good is better than none. And Oded, I can't imagine what it would have been like to have been a prophet in Israel in these days, right? Or in Judah for that matter. But Oded still spoke the word of the Lord, and while it didn't accomplish the sweeping reform and they didn't just turn away from their idols, that wasn't his message, right? They did listen to Oded's message. And so you can accomplish good even even a small amount of good is still accomplishing what God, the work that God has given you to do, and you're doing a good thing with eternal consequences.
He's reminded really of a command against what they did.
Exactly.
Leviticus 25, verse 46. Go into the land, you can make bonds, monotony, but over your brethren, the children of Israel, you shall not rule one over against the brethren.
Yep.
So it was a violation.
It was a clear violation of the law of Moses. That's right. So it definitely would have been adding to their sin of idolatry, which was another clear violation of the law of Moses. But yeah, you're very good point, Jimmy, there from Leviticus 25. Yeah, very good. Any questions about that? Yes. 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 Very good point. Very good application of what's happened here in the Old Testament. That God has always had a standard for the way His children, brethren, should treat one another. Definitely. Definitely. That's an eternal principle, I think, of treating your brethren, your fellow servants of God. Very good point. So Ahaz decides he wants to get some help. Ahaz decides he wants to get some help from Assyria. Remember, Israel and Syria are against Assyria, right? That's kind of why they've joined together. And Judah is, and this is conjecture, the Bible doesn't specifically say this, but I think there's evidence at this point that Judah's refusing to join that coalition, and that's why they're oppressing Judah, right? But nonetheless, they want to go against Assyria. So what Ahaz does, because of this oppression from Israel and Syria, he seeks Tiglath-Pileser to get some help. So he goes into the temple and he goes into his own palace and he gets gold and silver as gifts to send to the king of Assyria to ask him to come and help him in this battle against Syria and Israel. Now, that's kind of like, every now and then I have something that I'm going to do anyway that I already want to do. And then someone offers me some reward for doing what I was already planning on doing. That's a pretty good deal. And that's kind of where Tiglath-Pileser was. He already wanted to take Rezin and Israel. That was already on his list of things that he was planning to do. Now Ahaz says, I'll pay you to do it. and here's my offering. So that would have been a good deal for Tiglath-Pileser. He must have really enjoyed that, hearing that message. However, it shows again the character of Ahaz, does it not? In that, remember what was the commandment Isaiah gave him? Ask for a sign from God. God's not going to let them. God is not going to let Syria and Israel take you, right? That's not going to happen. Did Ahaz believe that? No, and I think it's clear he didn't believe that because he sought help from Assyria. So you see, Ahaz is complete disregard for the word of God in terms of his behavior, and also the Bible points out about Ahaz how that he was the first to offer. Well, the Bible doesn't point out, but it is the first mention of offering his sons in the fire. So the offering of human sacrifice, the valley of Hinnom. So Ahaz's character is deplorable. And we just see more of that in his handling of this war. In that seeking the Lord was completely foreign to him. It wasn't. It's almost as if the way, with the hardness of his heart, he was incapable of doing that. Incapable of seeing any good that could come from seeking the Lord. He had no trust in the Lord whatsoever. And so he sought Tiglath-Pileser to help him. And Tiglath-Pileser agreed. And one thing here is Ahaz desperately needed help, right? He didn't necessarily need Assyria's help, but he needed help because of the oppression from both the north and the south. And I think I want to show you, this is a map we've seen before, and this is the map just when we started a while back when Jehu was king. Do you remember that? When Jehu was king in Israel, and Josiah king in Judah, we had all of this, most all of this land, and Freddie had the nice little animation that showed not quite all of this, but most of this was controlled. This is showing the United Kingdom, but most of this was controlled by Israel and Judah, most of this land, right? And God was pointing out, I can do this, right? And over the last few lessons, what's happened is it's crumbled. It's completely crumbled. So here's a different map. Remember, we read this at the very beginning of the lesson, the entire east side, right? Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh, they're gone, right? So the east side's gone, okay? Then the text specifically mentions that Naphtali is taken away captive. There's lots of evidence. I didn't include it in the map, but you remember Naphtali was right there on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. That's where Naphtali's land was in the division of the land. And then you had Asher up here on the plains. The Phoenicians controlled this, right? Asher is no more, really. And then at this point, Zebulun controlled this Jezreel Valley, right? I think there's tons of evidence, even though the text doesn't specifically mention it, that Zebulun is also gone away and has fallen and been taken captive. The cities right up here, Kedesh, Abel Beth Micaiah, Dan, those cities in that area, they're mentioned as being taken away captive. So, and while that's going on, ooh, this didn't show up as well as I'd hoped, but there's oppression from Edom, and there's oppression from the Philistines pushing Judah. So basically what you have left is Jerusalem and Samaria. That's all that's left now in the kingdom. That's it. And so Ahaz is now here in Jerusalem, and he's got this trouble from the south, and he's got this trouble from the west, okay? And he's got this trouble from the north with Israel and Syria's coalition. And you know, Assyria has taken much of Israel, and there's this coalition between Damascus up here and Samaria right here is where that's where Pekah would have been reigning as king. So you've got, you know, that coming against Jerusalem. It mentions that Elath was taken. Elath would have been way down south, and that had been taken by Israel as well. Elath, just a quick mention, is Ezion-Geber. So all of this oppression from different nations all around just closing in on Jerusalem. Look at 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 19. Very key passage. For the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had encouraged moral decline in Judah and had been continually unfaithful to the Lord. Why is this happening? The text is very clear on that. And very clear on what's going on and why it's happening. And I didn't mention Isaiah 9, 1 and 2. And let's look at that. We have just a couple minutes. So I do want to, because he gives a glimpse of hope. And Isaiah prophesies in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. This is where I got the concept of Zebulun. Okay. As well. Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed, as when he first lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan in Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light, and those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. And that is looking forward to the coming of the kingdom. And where did Jesus do most of his work? You look at Matthew 4, Matthew specifically applies Isaiah 9, 1 and 2 to the days of Jesus. Okay? And remember where he did his work? In the region of Galilee, right? Naphtali, Zebulun. So that's even though they're brought low right now, okay, and they're lightly esteemed, Isaiah says, there will be glory in that land. Okay? That's coming. So there's that glimpse of hope, that prophetic hope. And I think secular history shows us that Megiddo specifically fell and was established as an Assyrian city. So, and that would have been in the land of Zebulun. But Isaiah points out that Zebulun was lightly esteemed during this time as well. Thank you. Any thoughts before we draw to close? Thanks.